This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Board the windows. Try to hide. They're coming.
They? Who are they?
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we're looking at 2007's animalistic take on vampires in 30 Days of Night. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including how albinism could develop, regeneration, and where we think these things evolved from on the Tree of Life, as well as a look at the history of vampires in cinema. As always, the show is broken up into a few different segments. There'll be time codes below, so you can skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. But before we get stuck in, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside Adam Harsik, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Alongside Adam is the Baroness,
Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup.
Dave is back with us this week. I think this is the first time that Dave and I have been on a podcast together in a month. No, 3 weeks, maybe.
Yeah.
Adam, you had some news?
In the past, we, Cinematic Animalia, ever had a handful of guests, and they've all been coming from the point of view of science. And they've all been scientists, researchers, people are familiar with evolution, ecology, physiology, so on and so forth. However, over the summer, I reached out to someone who's on the other side of what we like to do, the story side, the narrative
side. My side.
The Baroness's evil and imaginative side. And I reached out to an author, and he got back to us, and he's luckily willing and able to join us. So come November 14th, New York Times bestselling author Scott Sigler is going to join us for an episode on Slither.
Holy shit. Wow.
Scott is, a New York Times bestselling author of 16 novels, 6 novellas, dozens of short stories, and he's been running a podcast since 2005. He is one of the first people to do podcasting and be successful off of it.
Yeah, he's awesome. His books are awesome. If you haven't read him before, please check him out.
I first started listening to Scott's work in 2010 when a friend of mine had given me a ton of music and audiobooks and podcasts on an iPod that I had. And when I was in Shanghai, I was listening to a story when I was trying to go to sleep, and I stumbled upon Contagious, so the second book of the Infected trilogy. But ever since then, I've been hooked on Scott's stories because they do a really good mix of science fiction, horror, and science. He actually recruits and talks to actual scientists to try to make sure the science in his books is as accurate and realistic as possible. So it's something I've really come to appreciate, and I cannot wait to talk to him. I'm a big fan.
So this week we did 30 Days of Night, which originally was a comic book series. Who was it by?
30 Days of Night was Stephen Niles and Ben Templesmith.
So 30 Days of Night, the movie, is about a married couple that live in the northernmost community of the United States in Barrow, Alaska. It starts off with this mysterious stranger coming to town, wrecking shop, pretty much vandalizing any mode of transportation and communication off the out of the community. So it is not an island, but in many ways it is an island because it is so far north. The night, 30 days of night period that the North is known for comes, and vampires, or what people assume to be vampires, attack the town, killing pretty much everybody except for a handful of people. So
shit, it's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wholesale slaughter. Yeah.
Lots of.
Yeah, it's wholesale's a good word for it.
Punctuated at the end by our lead character doing something heroic and stupid to try and fight the vampires off.
I feel like there was a couple people that did just heroically dumb things.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, These are malnourished people who clearly haven't been sleeping that well. So we can cut them some slack. I mean, they're, you know, people in the face of irrational situations don't always make the most rational choices.
Yeah, for sure.
Having said that, Lance Hendrickson definitely should have not left his kid with those hillbillies. That's, you know, that's a different story. Not, yeah. I guess I'll start this week with what I liked about this one. I really like the fact that with so many vampire films, you see these amazing clean decapitations. In this film, whenever there's a decapitation, they're just hacking away at those necks. Like, it takes forever.
Which is what it should take.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, I took a really sick pleasure in seeing that. I love, so Danny Houston, people might know him from the worst X-Men film.
You're going to have to narrow that one down. There's a narrow that one down. There's the
X-Men Origins Wolverine, yeah. And he was also in the first Wonder Woman film as the fake-out villain. I loved his kind of middle distance horrifying stare.
Oh, that was him, wasn't it?
Yeah, I just thought he was really good in general. And I used the term before, I love the wholesale carnage of this. I thought it was good to see vampires just running loose as opposed to hanging around in the shadows. I thought this was a really fun take on this story.
Yeah, I mean, I had to kind of, feeding off of that, I definitely agree with the, this is one of my favorite vampire movies from the point of view of they're just animals. They're absolute bloodthirsty animals. There's no subtlety to it. There's no sexiness to it. Like an Anne Rice vampire, they're just, they're coming for your neck and they're going to eat you. And vampire Till Lindemann, the leader, the lead singer of Rammstein, look him up. He looks like the lead vampire. He's coming for you and he'll eat you.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's going to get you.
Oh, and, the isolation, I think, really plays into the story, making it the stakes so much higher. Like the open of the movie of, oh, the helicopter's down. Oh, our satellite phones have all been burnt up.
Weird.
The sled dogs have been murdered.
Worst part of the movie.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Real thing flashbacks. Yeah. I really appreciated that whole setup. It starts out really strong.
Yeah.
I really loved the intelligent dicks idea, that a creature that lives long enough would start approaching human beings if they're its food source, similar to like how some of my friends will talk about livestock in terms of like, oh, well, like, you don't have to worry. It's not an intelligent creature. It doesn't feel pain, or like, it shouldn't worry if we like hunt this for sport or do horrible things. These vampires, they're just cruel. They're not sweet or beautiful. Yeah. They're just awful. And I did love the feeling of like lack of hope, like the, just the like true feeling of desperation that creeps through this movie, trapped in the cold as these things run through the streets. Yeah. And it's not like we're going to find the super cure or like we've got a crossbow warehouse somewhere. Like we're just going to try to survive until the sun comes up.
Wait it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, it's only 30 days, but at no point did I think they were going to make it.
I mean, day one, I was like, no, they're dead in like 2 days. Max. Yeah.
Everybody's dead.
Yeah.
I've seen this movie before, and I forget that they go through the full 30 days. I'm like, oh yeah, it's been a while.
My favorite, absolute favorite part of this movie is Ben Foster. His affectation of his voice is just like, I don't know who came up with that, if it was him or a directorial choice, but chef's kiss. Like, what a fucking weirdo. What a beautiful weirdo.
I watched X3 The Last Stand the night before this when he's Angel, and to come into this film having just seen that was bonkers.
So great. It's funny because he's one of those weird movie lines that I quote all the time from this movie that nobody knows what I'm talking about. But it's because his voice was so strange to me that it really stuck out in my mind when I first saw this back in 2007. So I constantly would say, you know, thank you for the plastique. Give me what I want to eat, what I want to drink.
He seemed like he was having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what we call chewing the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
Sam, what didn't you like?
I didn't think this movie was anywhere near as tense or scary as it was going for. The director said that he wanted to make vampires scary again. I mean, they were certainly interesting, but I didn't feel that, like, I didn't really feel that tension. And I think, and Ben Foster might be a part of this, that it's cheesier than it's supposed to be as well. Josh Hartnett just gives such a pretty boy vibe all the time. I've never bought him as like a rugged, intrepid kind of man.
Yeah.
And I love him as an actor. I want to see more of him. One of my favorite films is still Lucky Number 11, or I think it was called something different in the States. But
no, that's it.
I love Josh Hartnett, but I don't buy him as this town sheriff role.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that for me, there's definitely bits that are tense. Like the final fight in the Utilidor where old man gets his hand ripped off by when he throws dude straight into the grinder. And there's some like very tense bits, but I think that the things I don't like about this movie are things that it just suffers from being a product of its time, of just all the vampires do the constant thing that every, quote, weird character in a movie does, which is like the head tilts and looking around like, I'm so weird.
Look, the middle distance stare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just so sick of seeing that. It takes me out of a movie every single time I see it. I think that's about it, really. I mean, it is cheesy, but I think it works.
See, I had the opposite problem of I had my partner watch this movie who hates horror movies, and I was like, I don't remember it being that bad. Fuck, this was brutal on a rewatch. The scene where like they grab his wife, the one character's wife, the dog owner's, and she gets dragged off underneath as they break his leg and just leave him there watching his wife get dragged off underneath the cabin into the darkness. Or the number of scenes that they have of them killing spouses in front of the other one, like stabbing the guy with the metal like firebrand in front of his wife before they eat her. Or even like the kids and the young girl that they're using as bait that they leave off into the snow, that they look cold and alone and they know they're going to die. And then they finally just end up like taking chunks out of her before they finally kill her. And my partner was like, so this is your definition of not that bad. And I was like, fuck.
I mean. Yeah, I like that from one standpoint because it's almost like a cat playing with its food, you know, and it's brutal. But I think for me, this movie definitely suffers a bit from its time. I could have done without the child violence. I felt like that was completely unnecessary. I think there's ways to show it without showing it.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the biggest thing that I did not like about this movie was it felt very anticlimactic. I feel like the beginning of this movie is great. It's just all this madness and chaos coming at once. People are trying to figure it out. And then there's this like slow tension of surviving and like waiting it out. And then the end is just like, I don't know. I felt like this movie could have done well with a better fight coordinator. Like the end fight between Josh Hartnett and Danny Heston was just like a slap fight. I just felt like it could have been a lot cooler, and it wasn't. It was just very visually uninteresting to me.
Which is a shame because the comic book this is based on, the visuals are so highly stylized. Like, it's really interesting to look at. I don't actually like it that much, but it is really interesting to look at. And it did feel a bit dull at times.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it definitely drags a bit. I will say, though, regarding the fight, one thing I definitely did appreciate is, as corny and kind of boring as the fight was, I liked that they took the time to make sure that Danny Heston was doing, like, swipes with his claws and not going for a punch, because a creature with claws like that is not going to go to punch you. It's going to swipe at you and try to take your fucking eyes out.
Yeah. Try, like, punching, like, obviously we won't put that, like, you punch like that, it's going to fuck your...
Yeah, when you make a fist, fingers up more your than fingernails go towards the palm of your hand. When you've got fucking 5 centimeter claws coming out of your fingers, it's going to be a problem when you punch somebody.
I really love the ending. See, I felt like the climactic, because it's the same in the comic as well. Just him sitting with her for the final sunrise. I adore that scene, and I adore the choice of, we don't see enough vampire movies where, like, taking on the curse knowing that you're absolutely fucked. Like, the minute he injects the blood, he knows regardless he's either going to get killed in the snow or they're going to have to put him down later. Like, it's a great scene in the comic as well.
I feel the comic benefits from the fact that the vampires talk and have conversations. Like, they are very much, the animalistic nature of the vampires is very much a movie addition. He has this brilliant dialogue during the final fight where the guy who's just become a vampire says, "This feels like disgusting. You people are pathetic for wanting to live forever like this." And it's really powerful. And then when he beats the other guy, which same way as in the movie, like that scene is pretty much straight out of the comic. Yeah. He says, "Get out of my town." And the vampires just scarp it because they're scared, which you don't really get like in this movie. They just kind of give up, it feels like.
It's like a weird alpha thing.
That's what I was about to say.
Well, in the comic, it's more powerful because none of them get killed in the comic. basically until he fights them at the end, where he sees a vampire can kill another vampire. So the implication is they really haven't faced death for the rest of the 30 days. And suddenly they're facing down the fact they could die. And for an immortal creature, for most of us creatures, it's like, nah, fuck, I don't want to die. I'll just fight another day. Bye.
No, Maggie, you're too beautiful to die. Take me. No, Kev, you're too beautiful to die. Take me.
In terms of trivia, I have a bunch, so we can just go through what I've got.
Cool.
Barrow is actually a real place. It was renamed in 2016 to, and I apologize, I think this is either an Inuit or an Aleut. I apologize for mispronouncing that as well. Name Utqiagvik or Utqiagvik?
It's Utqiagvik.
Utqiagvik, yeah. It was overturned in a 381-375 vote, so very fucking close. It was actually a draw the first time they counted the votes to respect the local indigenous people. It is... all the streets are completely unpaved due to the permafrost lying under the roads and under all the buildings, because you can't build a road on that shit without it cracking severely, like, every winter. And I have never been this far north. I've been up to Tromso, which is 69.74 degrees north. Barrow is 71.14 degrees north. But that sunrise you see at the end, I call absolute bullshit. When you're up that far north and the sun comes out, it does not look like that.
No.
It is like, it is still dark as hell. Like, you do get a little bit of light, but those days where the sun comes up for the first time and you see the sun for the first time in 30 days, you don't see the whole thing. Like, it might just crest over the ridge. What happens there is a good 2 to 3 weeks after the first sunrise.
For sure.
Fair enough.
I would say at least, yeah.
Not quite as climactic if they have to, like, push him up into the little bit of the sunbeam and slowly cook him like an ant underneath magnifying
just
glass.
Scalping his hair off real quick.
And it's going to last like 20 to 30 minutes maximum is when you're going to see any semblance of light. Like, the vampires could just like wait it out for half an hour and then come back.
Well, I was going to say some of the trivia that I have. It actually receives more than 30 days of night. So it has 24 hours of daylight from May 12th to August 2nd and 24 hours of darkness from November 18th to January 23rd. So
fucking hell.
Yeah, they would have all died.
Yeah.
That's like 2.5 months.
At the time of the year when that happens here, we get about 3 hours of sunlight. And like I said, it's not really proper sunlight. You get 3 hours of proper sunlight and then it's gone again. It's fucking hard. Like, that's one of the reasons that Norway increased the price of alcohol so much, is to cut down on suicide rates. And you see that in this movie. They're like, alcohol is illegal for this month, which
should be.
I'm not going to argue with. Yeah.
So it's also the indigenous group that lives there. It's one of the largest, I'm probably pronouncing this wrong, but Inupiaq settlements. Inupiaq. And the actual name Utqiagvik means the place where we hunt snowy owls, which I thought was pretty cool. In the film, so speaking of we were talking about the vampires talking earlier, they were worried that the vampires speaking English would sound dumb, and it would have. So they actually, with the help of a linguistics professor and the University of Auckland, because they filmed part of this in New Zealand, they created a fictional vampiric language that consisted of click consonants.
Oh, cool.
I like that a lot.
Because they wanted the vampires to be able to communicate in some form, but they thought they really wanted to go for that animalistic.
Yeah, so they kept everything pretty simple. And I would be remiss to not mention that Evan's character was originally Inuit in the comics, and they whitewashed him.
Yeah,
damn! I did not know that.
You mentioned before that this was in Auckland, which explains just the plethora of Kiwi and Aussie actors doing weird American accents to varying degrees of success. Like, I don't know American accents that well. I certainly don't know them up that far north. But Manu Bennett, who plays, I think, Billy in this film, he just sounded like a Kiwi. Like, I don't even... Was he trying?
He sounded like a weird American to me. It was like an accent I couldn't place, but he didn't sound Kiwi.
I felt like he was trying.
Okay, fair enough, yeah. I mean, to be fair, apart from, I think, the guy who turns into a vampire and voluntarily has himself beheaded, I feel he's the only one of the Kiwis who has a prolonged monologue. And I think he does a reasonable job. Like, he did a reasonable job in The Matrix, the one with the squid fight.
Revolutions.
Revolutions. Squid fight. Prequel to Squid Game.
Exactly.
Oh, we just finished watching that.
I just finished it today.
Yes, as a biologist, we're all very disappointed that there have been no actual squids.
Doesn't it look like a fucking squid?
Yeah, it does not look like a fucking squid. It
looks like a house.
If it's our time to die, it's our time. All I ask is, if we have to give these bastards our lives, we give them hell before we do!
Just before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And you can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in cinematicaanimalia and you will find us. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear more of the less movie-related ecology that Adam, myself, and a gigantic team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. So, today, I just want to say something before I let Dave take the reins, and that is that people forget, because the whole concept of this movie is, oh, it's Alaska, there's 30 days of night, it's perfect for vampires. But 6 months later, it's 30 days of just sunlight. Like, yeah. I think that really gets overlooked by the movie. Is the director counting on people not knowing how the Earth works, or...?
It's just such a sexy tagline that you don't really need to think about the other half of it, because it makes too much sense, Sam.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of what the opposite of a vampire would be that would want 30 days of sunlight, and the only thing that's popping up in my head is just Superman sitting on somebody's roof for 30 days. So
just sunbathing.
So just as an overview, so point one that I wanted to make, yay, we're finally doing vampires. And
yes.
Yeah.
Point two.
I feel the same.
Oh, good. These look fucked up. These do not look like traditional pretty boy Tom Cruise playing a piano vampire. They've gotten facial deformities. Their head is kind of swollen. Their eyes are a little bit further apart. Their skin is sort of the traditional pale white. Their nails cannot retract. Their teeth are out permanently. Their eyes have a
huge cheekbones.
They've got permanently dilated pupils. Or just black corneas in terms of like the tissue that makes up their eyes. Their eyes are almost completely black. And they do have modified speech patterns. So there's a couple of things we wanted to talk about is just like, this needs to be a thing. They can't just be drinking blood. We've had discussions before of species that consume blood on a regular basis are using it for iron breakdown and for various protein purposes, but blood is not a great meal to eat. It's not super nutrient dense. It contains a lot of shit you have to filter out, iron being the one big one, which I don't think is a problem for this, that either of you guys, did you either feel like these guys were drinking blood or did you feel like they were eating whole humans?
Well, I was going to say, by the way, I know a lot of mosquitoes that would really disagree with you, Dave, on that point, that blood does not make a good meal.
I mean, it works when you are trying to produce eggs, but outside of that, there's a reason the other mosquitoes do not eat. They don't need that protein.
I think that they show them like ripping into the bodies, but they don't really show the bodies too much afterwards.
Right.
I mean, they show the one guy's head on a pike.
Right.
But there's like nothing left of a lot of people.
And Ben Foster.
There's an enormous amount of blood on the ground.
Right. Ben Foster isn't drained in that cell. They come back later and they just find a blood smear if he's been dragged off or just eaten. The same thing with Grandma. And expression is never.
That's a good point.
The expression is never used, oh, they drained or they got her blood or whatever it is. Example, the kid says, like, when he's referring to his grandmother, he's like, they fed on her. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Now.
I mean, their teeth are definitely built for this kind of, like, tearing at and swallowing big chunks lifestyle, yeah, right?
And claws as well, right? I mean, it looks like these guys are designed to hunt.
Can I make the joke that grandmas always make sure you're well fed?
Now, for focuses on my section, basically what I was going to try to work with was the sort of aversion to sunlight, and then working my way through into increased strength, stamina, and as well as metabolic rate. And Adam and Libby are going to jump in where they can to throw points in as to like agreement or disagreement as we rock along. So the first thing is just general aversion to sunlight. I cannot make these guys burst into flames when they're hit by fire.
But can they sizzle and crackle and just go black? Because these vampires don't really burst into flames.
Which is cool. I loved as well that scene of when she gets hit by the light and the lead vampire is like, what is broken must be broken. Like, she can't heal from that tissue damage. They can come back from a lot because these guys take bullet wounds and other material, but I love that when their heads get blown off or when they get put through a big saw blade tractor thing, which I have no idea what the hell that is. I assume for cutting snow, but it is cool as fuck. They don't seem to come back. Yeah. The implication is they die. Now, the easiest connection that I can make that fits with the ocular changes that these groups of creatures are showing with these abnormalities associated with their skin and with reaction to sunlight is simply going to be albinism. So albinism is a congenital disorder characterized in humans and other animals by the complete absence of pigment in the skin, hair, and eyes. It's associated with a number of different vision defects. As well as the humans that are affected by this are far more susceptible to sunburn and cancer. In terms of the putting together the metabolism of melanin, because that is all this is. It's just the absence of a pigment. You don't have anything to protect your skin from the harmful rays of sun. The pathway that leads to the production of that chemical in your skin comes from the breakdown of a number of different sources. The big ones that I'm just going to focus on today are something called tyrosine, as well as actual melanin production itself. So tyrosine is the subunit that we basically build melanin out of. It's an internal protein.
Build a lot of things out of it, yeah.
There are a number of different enzymes that are responsible for its conversion. Now, really interesting, that change for basically making melanin, there's two big vitamins that are needed along the way. So one of which is vitamin C, that seems to be pretty vital for production of tyrosine, and vitamin A, which seems to be vital for the transition of tyrosine into melanin. Now, vitamin C, as we know, is collected from fruits. That's where humans got scurvy if they didn't eat a lemon every once in a while. And vitamin A is found in fruits like vegetables, carrots, sweet potatoes, peas. I'm not seeing our predator species eat either of these.
Nothing besides humans.
I was gonna say, so one of the things of vampiric lore that I stumbled on is a very real life disease called porphyria. Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever heard of this?
Yep. Yeah.
So this is where the myth of vampires being allergic to the sun comes from. So basically it's a disorder, a disease of a buildup of natural chemicals that produce porphyrin.
Porphyrin?
Am I pronouncing that right? Yeah. Those are essential for the function of hemoglobin in your body. And some of the symptoms of that are sensitivity to the sun, and that can cause blisters when exposed skin, usually on the hands, face, and arms, excessive hair growth, red and brown urine, which was attributed to the blood drinking of vampires. So it's kind of interesting that the real life symptoms are what kind of fed the lore of vampirism, especially in the Victorian era.
So building off of what Libby was saying about porphyria, there is another genetic condition you can inherit, which is perfect for a species or a subspecies of human, whatever we are going to call them, but we probably think they're a different species. called xeroderma pigmentosum. Basically, this is an autorecessive autorecessive genetic disorder, which means that it is a recessive trait that is usually overridden by a more dominant trait that gives you the, quote, healthier phenotype. But if you have two copies of this recessive allele, well, there's one of nine different genes that can cause it, you have a condition where basically your skin does not have the ability to repair damage from UV radiation. So the long and short of it is, when you get sunburn, it hurts for a while. You can have really, really severe burns sometimes, or you can even blister. But after a while, it goes away, the skin peels off, you get better, and it's fine. If you have xeroderma pigmentosum, your skin does not have the ability to repair that damage, and you'll just have this damage that just stays. People with this condition are incredibly sensitive to UV radiation, obviously, and they really need to go to extraordinary lengths to protect themselves from the sun. And it can also feed into some neurological disorders that can go with difficulty walking, speaking, moving, that kind of thing. So that could also fit into why these vampires have trouble with human speech.
Yeah.
Or at least English, I should say.
So what I'm envisioning is a combination creature, something that's in a situation where they've got underlying genetic problems, as well as they may actually have nutritional deficiencies for a mechanism that you and Sam are going to get into later related to cave dwelling. And as a result, their reactions to avoiding sunlight are exactly going to be more due to fear of permanent damage and sunlight trauma. It's more of like a hypersensitivity. It's not going to be like the sun hits them and they burn. It's just like, we don't want to keep going into the sun because this fucking hurts and it does a lot of damage afterward. We're going to avoid it.
Hmm. Yeah. My dad got two cancerous growths removed this last week, and the scars are horrific. So,
wear your sunscreen, folks.
Yeah, please wear your sunscreen. Because, I mean, yeah, we might be talking about it in terms of vampires, but it really kills a lot of people in the world as well.
One of the most common types of cancer you can get.
Mm-hmm, especially if you're a pasty-ass white boy like me.
Same.
Yeah.
Libby is a pasty-ass white boy. This is true.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their eyes, I think they just have some pupillary reset deficits in terms of their eyes are permanently dilated. To try and take in as much light as possible in these really dark settings, giving them that false sort of pure black-eyed appearance. I don't think the entire eye is black. If they are lacking pigmentation, there would be some other albinism changes associated with the eye, but they could still have those changes that you would see in the dark of it. Just looks like the pupil is huge. Now, the other last section that we just sort of wanted to move into was making humans super strong and super healy and super asshole-ish. Although the asshole part is going to be pretty easy because that's just humans. These guys have incredible healing abilities. They're super strong. They are also totally surviving in a freezing cold environment wearing cool leather jackets and dark clothes at all times that would not be warm enough for what they need.
Well, the lady's wearing a dress, so a little scary.
Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, she takes, like, more and more of her stuff off as the movie goes on. Do we actually see them heal? I know that they are super strong, and they are in this incredibly cold environment wearing basically nothing. But I don't... maybe in the book. I can't remember. I haven't read it in a long time. But I don't recall seeing them heal in the movie
at all.
So the
book, they do regenerate. The movie, it's just more implied, like whenever they take like these bullet shots or everything, they keep going and we then find them at the other scene. They don't seem to be showing obvious harm. My assumption, taking sort of a mid-abdominal bullet wound or a mid-thoracic shot, you're going to have to heal that material, right? These guys aren't bullet resistant. We see it go into the tissue and we see their heads get blown off quite clearly. And it seems to be implied that they can heal from anything except for the sunlight burns, which, Adam, fits really well with your idea of they may have an impairment in their ability to recover from that type of tissue damage. The same thing from the burn that they end up taking inside of the restaurant, where our lead character doesn't want to get eaten, so activates the dynamite, which for some reason doesn't kill him. The big trucker guy whose name I can totally forget.
Doesn't do anything to him. His legs aren't blown off or anything. He's standing right over a crate of literal dynamite.
So
he's got a little bit of a burn on one side of his face, and that's it.
I didn't even see that.
Yeah.
Throwing together a couple of changes that these guys could have that would allow them to do these types of things, I think they're going to have really aggressive stem cell populations. We know that kids heal a lot more rapidly and that certain tissues can be set to regenerate a lot easier. Oral or gingival tissue, if you've ever cut your mouth and it heals the next day, and you're like, oh my god, that's fucking amazing. the oral cavity is the fastest healing tissue in the whole body. If the rest of me could heal from damage like what takes place in my mouth if I burn something or chop something and it goes back to normal without scars, I would be so much happier.
And I think it's pretty fair to say that some crazy shit happens in Dave's
mouth. In terms of the stem cell population, so if these vampires just don't have the same sort of restrictions on their regeneration, they could have a much higher rate of regeneration to allow them to recover from this type of damage. They would have to be incredibly metabolically active, and we're going to talk about how I think this is the case later. And obviously, there would still be limitations. It wouldn't be instantaneous healing, but it could be more rapid. There are humans that are capable of more rapid healing than other humans. As discussed, I think they have a really high metabolic rate. These guys are not wearing shit all in the cold, and yet they are toasty warm, it seems, at all times. We do know that there are humans with adaptations like higher mitochondrial content or the right types of mitochondria that generate a greater degree of the energy that they consume and basically break it down as fat. Break it down as heat. Totally. We could rock these. And then increasing their endurance, their pain, their tolerance, their strength. All of this stuff is actually something that I stumbled on a couple of papers through the American Defense Organization discussing their plans to build super soldiers with really great citations where they were like, yeah, we're looking at these different compounds that we could increase in humans through genetic engineering to try and make them like more kick-ass. And I was like, that's kind of terrifying.
Dave, I think you're watching Captain America again and getting that confused with real science.
Were they, or were they trying to turn people into lizards? Okay, hang on. I have to interrupt because it's the second time Dave done this. Right, all those dumbass puns, right, that come, the titles, they are Dave's work. So remember that every time a joke comes up and Dave's like, very funny. It's Dave doing all the shit pun titles, okay?
Okay, that is fair.
Yeah.
So the suggestions that the papers I had found had made were increase pain sensitivity through increased production of endorphins and enkelfins. So basically that would explain why these guys really don't seem to show any damage. That's the other thing. Like, they get shot, they get hacked at with an axe, and they just keep fucking going. I do not get the impression that they either have great pain sensitivity to begin with, or they just have suppressive pain compounds, so natural painkillers that are in their system that are working fucking overdrive.
And it doesn't help that the movie is deliberately vague on a lot of this sort of stuff. Like, we see a lot of vampires get really messed up, but we don't know if they come back afterwards.
Yeah.
If we're looking to increase endurance, these guys can fucking run. They are, like, massing through, and we see that with the car scene. We see them with chasing vehicles, moving at top speed. They seem to really have a lot. Chemicals that would increase, ironically, their red blood cell production. So, example, erythropoietin. Lots of athletes go and train at high altitudes to naturally increase the number of red blood cells they have to help with their oxygen transport. Increased strength is just simply a matter of these guys can have higher quantities of adrenaline or cortisol. They can be in situations where they've got higher amounts of growth hormone to basically just make them really buff. And there's even been a discussion that, and we've talked about this before with the super muscly cows, if you have a myostatin inhibitor, you can make these guys just get really buff over time.
Back to the running thing really quick. All that explanation is great, but I think Josh Hartnett's little brother in the movie solved it with the line that he weighs less so he can run faster.
Right.
So all of these vampires just don't weigh anything. That's why they can run so fast. And also with the strength, I love how they can stop a moving vehicle, by just catching it. But that one vampire, the newbie vampire, gets caught in a swing set and can't break free of those chains. So
those old swings are fucking strong.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't make them like they used to. That's all I'm saying.
Exactly.
I mean, with that logic, though, I weigh, from the last time I looked at both his weight and my weight, a little bit less than Usain Bolt, so I should be a little bit faster, right?
Exactly. That's how it works.
Yeah, that's how it works, yeah.
I fucking knew it.
But these guys could just have a whole system of different chemicals and hormones and things running to give them some of these capabilities. Obviously nothing near to what we see, but they could have those compounds, and a lot of them will be transmitted potentially via the blood, which will become a discussion we'll talk about a little bit later with Josh Hartnett's transmission.
I'm fast as fuck, boy. Still fast as fuck, boy. Come get some.
Now for how these guys actually came about evolution.
Yeah. So I think that they're probably Neanderthals. We've touched on Neanderthals a couple of times briefly on the podcast for the purposes of talking about cannibalism and meat eating. But it's probably worth going into them on a little bit in a little bit more detail now. They're called Neanderthals because the first remains were found in the Neander Valley in Germany. Tal in German meaning valley. So Homo Neanderthalensis. Anything that ends with ensis, ensis just means comes from. So Neanderthalensis comes from the Neanderthal Valley. It's like Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis. They found her in Afar in Sudan, I believe.
I think so.
Yeah. And we actually shared the planet with the Neanderthals for a long time. We evolved, modern Homo sapiens to what we look like now, are thought to have evolved around 200,000 years ago. Neanderthals popped up about 400,000 years ago. Of course, we never know the exact start and end dates of these sort of things. And Neanderthals are thought to have died out potentially 40 to 60,000 years ago. So we did share the planet with Neanderthals for a very long time.
Not just shared the planet, we shared a bed. Wink, wink.
We certainly did. We've talked before about the fact that we interbred with Neanderthals a lot. And there is a fair bit of Neanderthal DNA remaining within a lot of people with European heritage. As Adam said before, it's like maybe, you know, like 0.5% in
half
most of us today.
0.5% to 2% at the most, I think.
Yeah. And in total, about 15% of the Neanderthal genome has still survived amongst Europeans in total. So you can find it, if you go through the whole of people with European heritage, you can find about 15% of the Neanderthal genome still intact.
Which is ironic, because generally speaking, other cultures and their representation don't survive the Europeans. So the fact that 15% has survived within the Europeans is pretty good.
Well, I mean, we don't know anything about their culture, so...
Fair enough.
Yeah. They were cave dwellers, which... potentially explains why this particular troop or a group have evolved to shy away from the light, because they've just spent so long within caves and potentially being active nocturnally. They competed with a lot of cave animals up here, like bears, cave lions, old hyenas, larger hyenas that used to inhabit parts of Europe. And okay, I have to talk about this really carefully. There's been a lot of images of Neanderthals portrayed as darker skinned, darker haired individuals. A lot of that has come from the desire of Europeans, white people in general, to not portray species that they consider to be more primitive as looking anything like them.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. So there's a lot more evidence these days that suggests that Neanderthals were much lighter skinned, which makes sense. They existed in more northern regions and had lighter hair colors and blue eyes as well. But yeah, there's a lot of evidence that suggests they could have looked a lot like these vampires we see here, with much whiter skin. A lot of these vampires have darker hair, but you know, what I'm saying is they don't have to be, you know, what the image that is traditionally given of Neanderthals, which is these swarthy, dark-haired, dark-skinned individuals.
They were a bit bigger, though, than Homo sapiens, and I think that the vampire that gets fought in the Utilidor, who has a bit of that might have been prosthetics, he might just have a really wide face, but that actor has a pretty big head and a very wide face, and I think that actor... Yeah, very broad cheekbones. I think that actor in particular, and there's another one in the movie as well, who fit very well that more Neanderthal facial feature structure, for sure.
I was just going to say, I really like this explanation for vampires, because one of the things that I studied back in college was the fact that Neanderthals had the larger occipital bun, which was used for, correct me if I'm wrong, but visual, it was like responsive for the visual cortex, which would explain them seeing better, and then also the cerebellum, which is like motor function, so they can move with a lot more precision.
Yeah, that's the working theory at the moment, that they had the larger brains than us because they needed to see better. It's nothing to do with intelligence. Yeah. There's a lot of competing theories as to what eventually happened to them. Hybridization with us is a very... I mean, hybridization is a thing that can remove species genetic signatures from the map completely.
It's a huge problem in conservation these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's a really tricky situation as well, because there are species which have cultural significance to people that are hybrids. The red wolves in North America, they're a hybrid species. If we let them spread, does that remove the more, I guess, air quotes, native genetic signature of grey wolves and coyotes that they have been interbreeding with? But I mean, look, this is getting a bit off track, but in my opinion, if there is cultural significance of a hybrid, I think that's a perfectly good reason to conserve it. But regardless, about 40,000 years ago, Neanderthals were gone. But the more, as well as the cave theory and the avoidance of light in general, I think that the more prominent piece of evidence, if you will, because we are nothing if not scientists, in which case we are nothing at times, is the fact that we know now that Homo neanderthalensis had a diet that was largely meat-based. A lot of them, we've used stable isotope analysis, which is basically analyzing old bones and fossils to check what the diet was. And we know that a lot of these things were potentially 80% carnivorous, and that many of them were cannibals as well. Now, in what situations they were cannibals, it's hard to say. I mean, we talked about Diane Fossey earlier in the year. She had recorded incidents whereby a gorilla in the troop, usually a mother, was being bullied, and the baby would just go missing. And there were bone fragments that turned up in scat later on. So, yeah, potentially the baby had been eaten. Again, she never found proof. And I don't know if they have found proof since. But it could potentially be the same sort of thing here. Weaker females, males, children could have been picked off and eaten by the rest of the tribe. It may have been what chimps do, which is when they'll, you know, go to war, which... that's not a turn of phrase. Chimps do go to war. They will eat members of the other tribe that are killed. And I don't think it's supposed to be so much of a show of dominance or to freak the other troop out as just, we've killed this, this is a supply of meat, let's eat it.
Yeah, it could also just be a dominance thing that you have with polar bears, lions, zebras do the same thing. Mm. When they want to have their genetic line propagated, they will kill the offspring of another male to then get rid of it, remove competition, remove the ability of the female to take care of those. That way the female will then be induced to be fertile again, and then they can produce themselves.
Yeah. And the working theory is that there were, for want of a better term, alpha males in Neanderthal tribes. In some of them... I think tribe works here. Yeah. In Neanderthal groups, in any case. And so, I mean, yeah, why not? That could potentially have been a thing. I am not enough of a human biogeographer to know, but I think that works as a much better mechanism for the progression from having humans as a sometimes food, your own species, sorry, as a sometimes food source, to preying on them extensively. But on that note, finally, before I pass it off to Adam's alternate theory, I would say that considering how long a species like this would need to evolve, there's no way they could only be preying on Homo sapiens.
No.
Before we were an agricultural society, human numbers were low. Before we crossed over out of Africa, Homo sapien numbers were minuscule. Like, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that, and I'll see if I can find the quote from the paper. Based on genetic studies of mitochondrial DNA, it appears that for the first 100,000 years, so that's 200,000 to 100,000 years ago, humans inhabited Africa in relatively small, isolated groups existing on the brink of extinction. That is not a prey species anybody wants to be dependent on.
No. No.
Yeah. So, if Neanderthals did exist and evolved...
They did exist.
Oh, yeah, sorry. If Neanderthals did evolve into a species that preyed exclusively on Homo sapiens, I think they would have gone extinct pretty quickly, because it's not a reliable food source at all.
No.
So they have to be eating other animals.
Other meat, but yeah, the jump from Homo sapiens ideally having a, you know, 70 to 90% plant-based diet and with some meat to Neanderthals eating 80% meat, and these vampires just seeming to exclusively feed on humans, but probably also other forms of meat. It fits physiologically, evolutionarily. It's a bit easier of a leap to make.
Yeah. And it doesn't necessarily mean that all of this species eats the same way. I mean, you have, you know, humans like Adam and Libby, who are strictly vegan, and then you have Jordan Henderson, who eats nothing but raw beef, apparently. Is it Jordan Henderson? That's the author, right? It's not the British football player?
Peterson.
Jordan Peterson. Yeah, Jordan Peterson, not Jordan Henderson. I think Jordan Henderson is a British football player.
I thought Sam was just taking a shot at one of his friends who listens to the pod and was like, you need to eat better.
No. Jordan Peterson is the person I'm thinking of. Jordan Henderson is an English professional footballer who we saw play in the last Euros.
That's right.
My apologies to Jordan Henderson. He looks like a lovely man.
Yeah, I think Jordan Henderson suffered enough abuse in the last couple months, if I remember who this player is correctly.
But yeah, I mean, perhaps vampiric populations are the reasons that the Homo sapien populations were always so low until they were able to move into different areas.
I mean, maybe, but the thing to think about with that is just that if you have a low prey population, you would just have a lower predator population. It doesn't necessarily mean that they wouldn't be able to exist at all. They would just be at a very limited number, which would cause what we call a bottleneck, which is when you have most of the population go extinct and you only have a bit of them left over, which could then lead to why these vampires have a lot of genetic abnormalities. Maybe it's some, like, these weird physiological features, why they have probably xeroderma pigmentosum, while they are maybe have porphyria as well, and then why they look weird physically.
Yeah, because the other thing is that if you're this dependent on day and night, you want to be in an area where day and night are very predictable the whole year round. You do not want to be living up north or down south. You want to be living at the equator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it could make sense to have them have, like, seasonal migrations, like you see with birds, where they track favorable environmental conditions. So maybe they are a bit further south when it's warmer, but in the cold, if they're able to then put out this enormous amount of body heat and not really need to worry about the temperature so much, going farther up north where there's these dependable, findable human settlements that have a couple hundred people, you know, they're not very well connected. It's not too hard to kind of get in there and grab some people, get out, and not have to worry about the sun while you're doing it. That could work.
Yeah. But in any case, like, this is all a fun theory for how these things evolve, but it doesn't explain in any way how they transmit this condition to other people if they're just a new species. But Adam, you have, like, an alternate take on this?
Yeah, so vampires have always had this weird contagious ability where, depending on the lore you're looking at, either just getting bit and then surviving will allow you to then transform into a vampire, or if you have the more Anne Rice, Bram Stoker, Dracula version where you have to drink some of the vampire's blood yourself to then kind of acquire the vampiric abilities, powers, condition, what have you. But in this movie, it just seems to take a bite, much like rabies, a virus, or a disease you get from a parasite, to then acquire this vampiric ability, this strength, these weird facial features, your teeth changing immediately, Josh Hartnett. And I think this this comes from some kind of either a parasite or a mutualistic symbiont that lives with the vampires. And this that leads into, it could be a variety of things that this kind of coevolutionary or this close relationship that these vampires, be they Neanderthals, have with this microbe. But I think that's what then allows them to transmit it to humans. And you see the humans struggling, for the most part, with this condition they're suffering from. John Reese, the first one who we see transformed, he looks terrible. He doesn't seem to be able to control his body very well. His mental faculties aren't all there. He's not quite sure where he is or how long he's been there. And I think this is the product of him somewhat adapting or adopting this mutualist, but it hasn't evolved with humans like it has with these Neanderthal vampires. So it's not a perfect fit. It's close enough because, I mean, humans, Homo sapiens, and Neanderthals did interbreed, like we were talking about with our DNA mixing. So we are close enough to have viable offspring, which, potentially, correlation does not equal causation, but potentially this also means that you could have this mutualist symbiont jump from a Neanderthal vampire to a human and potentially give some of the same, quote, perks, if that is what this thing is actually giving these Neanderthals.
Okay.
Yeah. Whether or not that changes your teeth, no, absolutely not. But changing your behavior, maybe the way your eyes operate, your muscle function, maybe a little bit.
Okay. Would it be able to jump to a different species?
I think so. I mean, that's what I was saying about the interbreeding. Like, usually these kind of things are very, very tightly co-evolved with their host. especially special parasites in particular, but also a mutualist. It's something that you are evolved with. Like the mitochondria in our cells is a mutualist arrangement where it's an organism that was incorporated into our cells, and then we get something out of it, they get something out of it. So having this organism evolving with these Neanderthal vampires means that it's going to be geared towards them somewhat, if not a lot. But the fact that humans, Homo sapiens, and Neanderthals were able to breed and have viable offspring makes me think that they are close enough for the symbiont to then jump from Neanderthals to the humans.
And just as the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
I was yes. Sitting on it the whole time.
There you go.
Yes.
I was just like, I'm going to say it. I have to get it out. I'm going to feel all bad all day if I don't say it now.
Bill Nye would love you.
So just as one last thing regarding biology before we move on. The vampires, and this happens a lot. This is up there with carnivores like roaring at their prey for me. The vampires are just walking around like snarling for no reason whatsoever. Like... in any kind of animal that snarls, when it does it, there's always a reason for it. Like, perhaps they're baring their teeth in a show of aggression or a show of friendliness or affection. Cats, for instance, they have this, like, kind of snarl that they do, but that's actually got to do with, like, scent glands that they're spraying around. Like, big cats do it as well. Like, you'll see just lions standing there and all of a sudden they do this weird, like, kind of very messy, kind of very pug-nosed, snarly face, like... but they're like spraying shit around a lot of the time. But these vampires are just like walking through the middle of people's houses, just like snarling. And I don't know why they're doing it. Could they be spraying scent around marking territory as well? Maybe, because that's the only thing that makes sense.
Neurodegeneration due to a disease or their own crazy amount of inbreeding they probably have.
Hmm. Yeah. So their version of Tourette's, maybe. They're just constantly snarling.
Maybe. So we have the physiology, we have the ecology, but what about the lore of the vampires?
Yeah. Yeah, the lore. I am the lore!
I was going to say, my section's a little bit... I went all ham, sorry. So feel free to cut some of this. But...
I was going to explain what going ham is to our non-North American listeners, but I think there's like five of them, so they can Google it.
When you turn into a ham. So yeah. I'm going to start with the folklore. So this is actual, you know, ancient storytelling passed down. So what I find interesting is that in folklore, vampires are very differently depicted than what we know them as today. So originally vampires were described as wearing shrouds, being ruddy or purple colored, like their actual skin. As well as being bloated with blood seeping from their orifices. So think human tick, because that's like a leech. What it was. Yeah, so their physical attributes were often, you know, in response to the blood-sucking or the vampirism, which is the feet.
Fat vampire week, baby!
Exactly. vampires suffer from arrhythmomania. It's a hard word to say. So popular folklore defenses for vampirism include spreading millet or spilled sacks of rice. So the undead bastards would spend all night counting each grain instead of doing their
murders. I've heard of that one.
Yeah. I have no idea where this lore came from, of the fact that they suffer from this OCD counting. But
individuals suffering from this disorder have a strong need to count objects in their surroundings.
Yep. Yeah.
That is bonkers. I've never heard of that before.
You've never heard of that?
No, yeah, never.
Yeah, funniness in a couple of different like comedy films that involve like the creature chasing you down and somebody spills something and the creature's like, I will fuck you up in an hour.
After I count this.
Yeah.
Count all
God,
this
just
rice.
Take them to a beach.
Uh-huh. Oof.
So, corpse prevention included burying your loved ones upside down, severing their tendons at the knee, because how dangerous can a hobbled vampire be? And burying the body with sharp objects like sickles so that when it would arise, it would pierce the bloated skin and pop. So they would bury it with all these like knives and sharp weapons so it couldn't move around.
This feels like a really good business pitch to be the dude who sells sickles outside of the cemetery and be like, oh, this is, you gotta bury it so you can't reuse it. See you soon.
at least five sickles.
I wonder if when Bram Stoker's Dracula was written, there were, you know, whatever the late 19th century equivalent of neckbeards were just going around, well, these aren't my vampires. Like, Dracula's not my vampire. This is, it's not really sticking to the source material.
He's not even purple.
Yeah.
So vampire identification often included leading a virgin boy through a graveyard. I'm not sure how this worked, but Dave, if you're up for it later, we can try and see what happens to you.
Jesus. Just going for the jugular.
Well, Dave, you're the only one who's not married, so
exactly.
You have to.
Exactly. That's why I chose Dave. Because, you know, we're all chaste.
Okay, like, I know we've gone past this, but I feel the need to bring it up because this is my favorite piece of trivia ever. The Count from Sesame Street, the vampire, has arrhythmomania.
Mm-hmm.
He does.
That blows my mind.
From the folklore.
Yeah, and he's purple. Yeah. Holy crap.
That's fantastic. I didn't even think about that. That's fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I know. That's my favorite piece of trivia we've ever come across on this podcast.
All right. So apotropaic magic, which is warding, included garlic, a branch of wild rose or hawthorn, crucifix, rosary, holy water, consecrated ground, the classic sprinkling of mustard seed on your roof, mirrors.
Classic. Like
that old classic.
We do it all the time here in Israel.
And the personal invitation in the house. But folklore actually states nothing about sunlight. That came much later with the porphyria and the likely Victorian craze of vampires in literature. Cool. So killing them was pretty much a whatever. it was like a lot of different things could kill a vampire. Definitely the wood stake through the heart, especially in the Christian areas. It was very common to use wood that was thought to be the cross that Jesus died on, like what it was made of. So there's debate about which wood that was. Metal. Or iron stakes as well. Garlic in the mouth, decapitation, stakes through the legs, dismemberment, then burnt, jeez, drowning, and then bullets.
The things that would just kind of kill anybody?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. I think the bit of trivia that I read was as early as the 19th century, it was still common in some, I think it was Eastern European communities to still shoot a bullet through the casket as you were burying your loved one just to prevent vampirism.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's sort of the folklore. The literature, beginning anyways, I'm not going to go too far into this, but basically it comes from folklore. So tales that were told in European folklore of undead that caused mischief or even deaths, specifically in neighborhoods that they had lived in their life. But the term vampire was coined in Western Europe after stories leaked of an MPI occurring in Eastern Europe and the Balkans area in which it said vampirism and corpse staking occurred. And what is an MPI, you ask?
Yes.
An MPI stands for mass psychogenic illness, also known as mass hysteria. And I strongly encourage you to look these up because this shit is wild. So another notable historical example of a recorded MPI was in the Middle Ages called, and I shit you not, the Dancing Manias, where thousands of people were stricken with the uncontrollable urge to boogie down and would not stop until they collapsed from exhaustion. They have no idea what caused this phenomenon to this day.
They were just like,
there was a jumping one too in France, I think. People just jumped nonstop for
I'm
hours,
just imagining
days.
The world's greatest dickest DJ who just will not drop the beat, who it just keeps like building up over courses of your days, and you're like, it's about to drop! It's about to drop!
It's giving me anxiety. I hate that.
Yeah.
But I think it was a cyanide and happiness comic that's like, hey, I got your results back, and you have boogie fever! It's fatal.
Yeah, I saw that.
So the first classic brooding, pale-faced, lady-loving vampire came from John Polidori, who is an English writer and physician called The Vampire, with a Y.
Hmm.
And that was part of the same night that what happens when a bunch of Georgian-era writers get trapped inside during bad weather. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with this story, but Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, and John Polidori all got stuck inside in a rainy day and were really bored. And so Lord Byron suggested they each go in a separate room and write the best horror tale. So that is where we got Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus. And that's also where we got this tale called The Vampire, which is also funny because John Polidori was Lord Byron's physician. And if you don't know anything about Lord Byron, know that he was kind of a dick. And so he actually based The Vampire, this asshole who essentially feeds on these women and then leaves them, on Lord Byron. And then in a twist of fate, Lord Byron was actually credited for that work for many, many years. And then was recently discovered that his physician, or the John Polidori, actually wrote it. So
It was a quote I saw a while back. It was basically, I wonder how all these fucking misogynistic sci-fi fanboys would react if they find that their entire genre was founded because Mary Shelley was sick of Lord Byron's shit for a full weekend.
Exactly. So, Bram Stoker's Dracula is often hailed as the quintessential vampire story, although he was predated by 26 years by a novel called Carmilla by Sheridan Le Fanu, if I'm pronouncing that correct, who is an Irish writer, as well as a Penny Dreadful titled, and I love this title, Varney the Vampire.
Varney the Vampire. It's me, Varney the Vampire.
It's me, Varney the Vampire. Yeah, and Varney is actually one of the first ones where they got the fangs.
Okay.
They gave him the protruding teeth. So Bram Stoker was inspired by Vlad the Impaler, but like every author before him, he was inspired by those works of literature. So he was inspired by Varney, he was inspired by Carmilla, he was inspired by the vampire, and so on and so forth.
Just want to say, I've actually been to the house where Vlad the Impaler grew up in Sighișoara, in Romania. It's next to a graveyard that is spooky as fuck.
Cool.
I would love to go.
It is really cool. Sighișoara in general is a beautiful student town in Transylvania. Transylvania is just fucking gorgeous. Everybody should go when travel reopens up. It's fantastic.
That's awesome.
This section sponsored by the Transylvanian Tourism Agency.
We got
and
vampires.
And Vlad the Impaler. So that's kind of it for literature. Obviously, we have all the modern takes, like Anne Rice and so on and so forth. But I just wanted to sort of go into the beginning of how vampires started. So then in film, I'll touch on that briefly as well. The first portrayal of on-screen Dracula was a German silent film called Nosferatu, which is phenomenal, 1922. But the first speaking vampire film was 1931's Dracula, played by Bela Lugosi, which is referenced in 30 Days of Night, which I really appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then we have Christopher Lee, who is well known for his portrayal of Dracula in the late 50s and 60s. And then in the 70s, we got Blackula and a few films with the reintroduction of everyone's favorite trope, the lesbian vampire, based off, actually, the story Carmilla. So then we have everything from Buffy to Blade to Interview with the Vampire.
Blade.
Yeah, to True Blood, Vampire Diaries, and some glittery thing that will not be mentioned.
Which, I will say, one of those films was directed by the same guy who did this film.
Oh, shit.
I do want to tell, I'll have Adam tell this story. I don't know if it's a story, but one of my favorite things that Adam told me when we started dating was that he has three other siblings, and they moved around a lot when they were kids. And so in high school, they moved to a new school, and that was right around the Twilight era. And so apparently the school called them the Cullens.
Oh, my God.
Fella, this is Esme, my mother, for all intents and purposes.
Buongiorno.
Molto bene.
I was going to say, on that note, do we want to go through our top three portrayals of vampires in any media?
Yes, please.
I still love the first Blade movie.
Fuck yeah.
I think it's fantastic. I know the second one's supposed to be, you know, it's a little more critically acclaimed, but I love the first one. And it also has some of the most laughable late 90s CGI you've ever seen in your fucking life.
It also has the blood orgy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. I just think it's really interesting, but not necessarily great, but I have to put in my top three just because I love the first two kind of runs of American Vampire, the comic book. It really starts to fall apart about kind of the third, I don't know what you call it in comics, but season in. Okay. You know, when a comic book kind of starts and then starts up again, runs, I guess you would call them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really fascinating. Like, different breeds and species of vampire interacting around the globe, I think is fantastic. And it's got that dose of Americana that, for instance, American Gods has as well, which is really interesting from a non-American perspective.
Cool.
And then, I don't think it's fantastic, but I really like the concept behind Daywalkers.
I always forget about that movie, and I love that movie.
It's so good.
Daybreaker, do you mean?
Is it Daybreakers? Yes, the Daywalker is fucking Blade again. Yeah. Daybreakers, it's I hate the washed out color palette. I hate it. It makes my face hurt. But the concept of vampires having taken over and humans running out and vampires being, oh fuck, what do we do now? I think it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's not tackled super well, but I think it's a really interesting film, and I love seeing all these, again, just random Aussie and Kiwis pop up doing their very best American accents.
Sam Neill, baby.
Yep.
I'll go next. My three, I'm going to do it 3-1, so third first. I would be remiss if I didn't mention Christopher Lee, because Christopher Lee, so he's just phenomenal. You just look at a screenshot of him as Dracula, just like, yeah, I want to watch that.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Number two is the cast of What We Do in the Shadows, yeah, TV show.
Yes.
I love all of them, but specifically the TV show. I really did enjoy the movie, obviously phenomenal, but I don't know if it's just because it's a longer form, because I'm getting to know the characters more because it's a TV show, but those three are just great. Yeah.
Colin Robinson.
Yes.
Having said, I agree that I think the TV show is better, but I don't think the TV show has a single line that is as good as, I think vampires like virgins because, you know, it's like when you have a sandwich, it's always better if you know no one's fucked it.
So good. And then number one of all time, Bow to the King, Bill Nighy, Underworld.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Phenomenal.
He's so good
absolutely love Bill Nighy. Anything that he does, I'm like, I'm sold. I'm in. Yep. 100%. And he is so good as just this lord, you know, father figure in those series. I love him.
I think, you know, keeping with the theme, 30 Days of Night is definitely one of my favorites, just from the point of view of, I love this portrayal of what vampires are. They're just such the polar opposite of what you see in other movies of a sophisticated, sleek, you know, high culture creature that lives forever and is above the petty squabs of humans. Like, no, these are just fucking rabid animals. They're just coming for you and they're going to tear your fucking throat out. So that's definitely up there. Agreeing with Sam as well for Blade, that is, young Adam was very into the Blade movies. Current day Adam still likes them, hasn't watched them in a while, but Wesley Snipes as Blade was fucking fantastic.
Absolutely.
And seeing that world of this weird, you know, late 90s, early 2000s rave culture of vampires ruling over it, and they live in society, but not really, because it's still kind of separate, but there's a little bit of weird magic in there with Stephen Dorff doing weird shit. That is really cool. And I love all those weapons were badass. I had Blade's sword. I got it at a pawn shop, which was really, really cool. And I don't know what happened to it, but it was great. And I think my favorites are going to have to be the Anne Rice vampires. So I really, really enjoy the weird Eastern European, like, mystical, sexy flair of vampires. And I feel, and also the weird, like, everything Anne Rice does is related to Catholicism, because I think that she had a bad experience with it. But I think having those weird religious undertones, and because I grew up Catholic, and I'm what they call a recovered Catholic. Having those weird undertones really makes me appreciate things like Anne Rice, where there's those weird church undertones to everything, and it relates back to magic or this weird, they're above humans. It's a separate thing that is taking place in the same area as humans, and it only interacts somewhat. And I, of course, really enjoy Tom Cruise's The Vampire Lestat.
I was going to say, just to interrupt before Dave goes, quick shout out to the Victorian era for anything that we love in most modern media comes from these crazy bastards. Like, they were the inventors of the medieval tropes that we have, where we have like chivalry, knights, that kind of stuff. They invented that. Piracy, how we view it today, they invented that. Vampirism and horror, seance, undead, they invented that.
Horns on the head of the Vikings.
Anything that we usually enjoy comes from them.
They were good storytellers, yeah.
So I want to take a slightly different direction because I think it's going to get a laugh out of like our various characters. So, serious vampire movie. Did you guys ever see Only Lovers Left Alive?
Oh, I was hoping someone mentioned that. No. Yes, it's... Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. Tom Hiddleston, Tilda Swinton, this kind of depressing but beautiful film about these vampires that think they're better than all the other vampires.
Oh, they're such fucking snobs.
Yeah, about like Tesla being better than Edison, and they have these like fantastic scenes where like ex-lovers come back in, and after all of their bullshit at the end when they're both dying and they think they're ready to come to terms with death, this like young couple wanders by them and they're like, or, and like the final scene is just them like wandering after this young couple, and you're like, you fucking dickheads. Fantastic.
Yeah. And spoiler, but that last scene is the only time you see them show their fangs in the entire movie.
Great, great film. Cannot recommend enough.
But the worst fucking hipsters ever.
Which a vampire absolutely would be.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like, well, I mean, Constantinople. Oh, sorry. I mean, Istanbul, I guess, as it's called these days.
The second, just because if you guys have not checked it out, the 2011 remake of Fright Night with Colin Farrell, Anton Yelchin, and David Tennant,
right?
Fucking hilarious, and features one of the best scenes ever of Anton Yelchin like locking the door and being like to Colin Farrell's character, he's like, "You can't come in. You need permission to enter the house." Which then features Colin Farrell blowing up the house, and he's like, "Don't need permission if the house isn't there." And it's such a great scene. And then my final, just because it kind of popped out in recent years, and I still get a chuckle. I fucking hate Adam Sandler, but man, do I like the Hotel Transylvania series.
Yeah,
and I love his stupid Dracula. In terms of just like, he's funny, he's lovable. I really like relate to that character, and I think they've done a fantastic job with that whole series.
I almost put that on my list as well, because I do love Adam Sandler. I've always loved him, but I think his portrayal of Dracula is just so fun.
I had it in my head for the longest time, because I'd never actually seen any of those films until I sat down with Eric recently, because he loves them. And I had always thought that that character was played by Nicolas Cage. So I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be fun. And then Adam Sandler's voice comes on. I'm like, oh, no, I'm leaving.
I think one I forgot I want to throw in as an honorable mention, which kind of tying back to the 30 Days of Night and the Lack of Sunlight, is the Swedish movie Let the Right One In, about a little girl vampire who moves in next to this kid who gets bullied. And it's a pretty dark and fucked up movie, but it's a really cool representation of vampires in the modern world. And remember, the Swedish version, not the shitty American remake that Americans love to make.
Was the American remake garbage? Oh, okay.
Apparently. I've never seen it. I don't want to.
No, they're good every now and then. Let the Right One In was an American remake. No, Only Lovers Left Alive was an American remake. Oh. Yeah, it's a Korean film, I think.
Proverb today is, even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Did we feel bad for the monsters this week?
Nope.
No.
Nope.
Nope.
No. No. No.
Big old group of dicks.
Okay, next section. So, would we recommend this movie?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I made the mistake of this movie is absolutely brutal. And again, I do apologize to my partner. That was my fuck up. I have not quite recovered from that problem yet, but it, like, as long as you've got a strong stomach and you are willing to see darkness, this is a fantastic film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fun, yeah, for sure.
All right, Adam.
So
next week's June, right?
Next week is June.
June.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
I think you'll find next week's bloody November, mate.
bloody
got him.
We got the chuffed. We got the chuffed in there. We're good. Yeah. Next week is Dune, and it's got me chuffed. So remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye bye.
Bye guys. Bye.
There's some teeth. They're like vampires, you know?
Vampires don't exist, Jake.
That cold ain't the weather. That's death approaching.
They're tearing through everyone's home.
We can last the month.